A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
So it gave me a skeleton.
It inferred one. There's a difference.
That's my point. It looked at a few photos of me and decided, where my shoulder joint should be, not where it is, where it should be. I don't know if I find it impressive or presumptuous.
Both, probably. Daniel's been doing exactly this, feeding images into Meshi, getting back a fully rigged model of you, and he sent us a prompt about it. Let me read what he wrote.
Go on.
He says, I generated a three-dimensional model of Herman Pobbleberry using Meshi, feeding in images and getting back a rigged, textured model. The thing that struck me was that it isn't one step. It's a pipeline of named stages, and one of them was surprisingly intriguing. It added a mock skeletal structure so the object would deform sensibly when it moved.
The skeleton? Yes.
He wants an episode walking that process end to end, naming each stage properly and explaining what's actually happening computationally. Start with image to 3D and how it differs from classical photogrammetry. Multi-view capture, structure from motion, feature matching and point clouds in the classical case versus generative multi-view synthesis and neural reconstruction in the AI case. Then the geometry stage, point cloud or implicit field to surface, isosurface extraction, the raw high density mesh, and why it's an unusable soup of triangles. Then remeshing and retopology, turning that soup into clean quad topology with sane edge flow, and decimation to a workable polygon budget. Then UV unwrapping, cutting seams and flattening a 3D surface into 2D texture space, and why that step is quietly one of the hardest. Then texturing, projecting, or generating the albedo map and the rest of the PBR stack, and baking detail from the high poly mesh into normal maps. Then the stage that fascinated him. Auto-rigging, fitting an armature of bones and joints inside the mesh, and skinning, where every vertex gets weighted to one or more bones, so the surface deforms plausibly when a joint rotates. He wants us to explain weight painting, why bad weights produce the classic collapsing elbow artifact, and how rest pose, bind pose, and animation retargeting fit together, so you can drive a generated character with an off-the-shelf animation clip. Then he adds, parenthetically, Herman can have opinions about having his own skeleton inferred by a machine.
I do. I have several.
So let's warp that pipeline end to end, name each stage properly, and explain what's actually happening computationally, starting with a fundamental philosophical shift. Because there's one.
A big one, and it's sitting right at stage one.
The cool thing to understand is that generating a 3D model from an image isn't one step. It's a pipeline of named stages, and each one is a decades-old research problem with its own literature, its own failure modes, its own expert craft knowledge. Meshi presents itself as a one-click solution. Upload an image, get a rig character, but underneath, it's running 6 or 7 distinct computational stages that each took entire PhD theses to solve. Understanding those stages is what separates a user who can debug failures from one who just hits generate and hopes.
And the arc we're going to trace, we start with the philosophical shift from measurement to imagination, then walk each computational stage, and end with the skeleton, my skeleton, the one it invented.
That it did. Let's start at the very beginning. How do we go from a flat image to a 3D shape at all?
So there are two completely different ways to answer that question, and mixing them up is the single biggest misconception people have about this technology. Classical photogrammetry versus AI image to 3D. They produce similar looking outputs, a 3D mesh, but the underlying philosophy is fundamentally different.
Walk me through classical first.
Classical photogrammetry is a measurement science. You need 50 or more overlapping photos of an object taken from every angle, typically on a turntable with controlled lighting. The pipeline goes like this. Step 1, feature detection. Algorithms like SIFT or ORB scan every image and find distinctive points. corners, edges, texture patterns that can be reliably identified across multiple photos. Step 2, feature matching. The algorithm finds the same feature point in multiple images, which tells it how those images relate to each other spatially. Step 3, structure from motion. Using those matched features, it solves for the camera position of every photo and produces a sparse point cloud, a few thousand 3D points that represent the object's surface. Step 4, multi-view stereo densifies that into millions of points. Step 5, Poisson surface reconstruction converts the dense point cloud into a mesh.
So it's measuring something that actually exists.
It's triangulating real geometry from real photographs. The result is geometrically accurate. If you photographed a coffee mug, you get back a mesh that matches the real mug's dimensions within sub-millimeter precision. But it fails completely on reflective surfaces, transparent surfaces, or anything without enough visual texture. A shiny chrome sphere produces no features to match, and critically, you get no texture beyond the projected photo color. No roughness map, no metallic map, no normal map.
And if you only have one photo?
Classical photogrammetry gives you nothing. It needs those overlapping views to triangulate depth. Which brings us to the AI approach, and this is where the philosophical shift happens.
The machine imagines the back of the object.
That's exactly what it does. Modern AI image to 3D, the kind Meshy 4, 5, and 6 use, works from a single image or maybe 2 to 4 photos. The core innovation is something called generative multi-view synthesis. A diffusion model, related to architectures called 01 to 3 and MV Dream, takes your input image and hallucinates what the object looks like from every unseen angle. It generates a full set of consistent multi-view renders, front, back, left, right, top, bottom, from that single photo, not by measuring anything. By drawing on statistical patterns learned from millions of training models.
So it's seen enough donkeys to know what the back of a donkey probably looks like.
Probably, yes. Then a second stage takes over, neural reconstruction. Typically, a neural radiance field or a 3D Gaussian splatting variant converts those synthesized views into an implicit 3D representation. An implicit field is a continuous function. You feed it an XYZ coordinate, and it tells you whether that point is inside or outside the object. It's not a mesh yet. It's a mathematical description of a volume.
And this is where the measurement versus imagination distinction really lands. Classical photogrammetry is finding geometry that was always there. The AI is inventing plausible geometry. When it infers your skeleton, Herman, it's not discovering bones. It's deciding where bones should go based on what it learned from millions of other models.
Which is why I said presumptuous. The machine has never seen inside me. It has no CT scan, no X-ray. It looked at my silhouette and said, statistically speaking, the shoulder joint is probably about here, and it might be right. But it might be close enough. What does accuracy even mean in that context?
It means plausible deformation, not anatomical truth.
Right, and that's a different goal entirely. But let's stay on the geometry for now. So we've got this implicit field, a sine distance function, or a density field. The next stage converts it to something we can actually use.
The geometry stage, implicit field to surface mesh.
The algorithm that does this is called Marching Cubes, published by Lorentzen and Klein in 1987. It's elegant. You divide 3D space into a grid of tiny cubes, voxels, and evaluate the implicit function at each corner of every cube. If all 8 corners are outside the object, nothing happens. If all 8 are inside, nothing happens. But if some corners are inside and some are outside, that cube straddles the surface. Marching Cubes looks up a pre-computed triangle pattern for that specific configuration of inside-outside corners and generates the triangles that approximate the surface passing through that cube.
And you do this for every voxel in the grid?
Millions of them. The output is a raw triangle mesh, and in Meshy's case, it can reach nearly 600,000 faces for maximum fidelity. That sounds impressive until you look at what you actually have. It's watertight, it's geometrically accurate to the implicit field, but the triangulation is completely irregular. No coherent edge loops, no regard for where the model needs to deform, no polygon efficiency whatsoever. The documentation calls it what it is, an unusable soup of triangles.
Soup. That's the technical term.
It's the right term. You can't animate it, you can't texture it cleanly, and you definitely can't put it in a game engine without bringing the frame rate to its knees. So, we've got our soup of triangles. Now we need to turn it into something usable, and that's where the real craft begins.
Remeshing and retopology.
Remeshing is the process of rebuilding that triangle soup into a clean, efficient mesh. Meshy has a remesh tool that does this. It produces clean quad or triangle topology with an editable polygon count, and it generates edge loops automatically along the curvature lines of the model. You can choose quad topology, which is preferred for rigging and animation, because quads subdivide predictably and deform cleanly, or triangle topology, which is what game engines ultimately convert everything to anyway.
And retopology is the manual version of that.
Retopology is the art of creating a brand new mesh that conforms to the high detail surface but with proper edge flow. Edge flow means the edges of your polygons follow the natural creases and deformation lines of the model. Loops around the eyes, concentric rings around the mouth, loops that wrap around the shoulders and knees. If your edge flow is bad and you try to animate the character, you get visible pinching and unnatural creasing at the joints. It looks like the character is made of crumpled paper.
So edge flow is basically anticipating where the mesh needs to bend.
And decimation is the third piece, reducing the polygon count to a target budget. Meshy's export dialog has a reduce polygon slider and a low poly mode that produces clean topology light enough to drop straight into a project. The key insight here, more polygons doesn't mean better quality. Clean topology with proper edge flow at 5,000 polygons will animate better than a messy 600,000 polygon soup.
This is where the one-click illusion starts to crack. The AI gave you a shape, but making it usable is a whole separate set of problems.
And the next problem is quietly one of the hardest in all of computer graphics. UV unwrapping.
Explain what a UV actually is.
A UV coordinate is a 2D address on a texture map. Every vertex on your 3D mesh needs a UV coordinate that says, when you're painting this part of the model, sample this pixel from the texture image. UV unwrapping is the process of cutting the 3D surface along seams and flattening it into a 2D plane. And it's fundamentally impossible to do without distortion.
Because you can't flatten a sphere without stretching it.
Or cutting it. Any 3D surface that's topologically equivalent to a sphere can't be flattened onto a plane without either distortion or seams. The art is in placing the seams where nobody will see them. Under the arms, behind the ears, along the symmetry line down the back, and then minimizing both angular distortion and area distortion across the rest of the surface. Angular distortion makes straight lines look wavy. Area distortion means some parts of the model get more texture pixels than others, so you get blurry close-ups next to sharp regions.
And texel density.
Texel density is the number of texture pixels per unit of 3D surface area. It needs to be uniform. If the face gets 4 times the pixel density of the torso, the face looks crisp and the torso looks like it's from a 1995 PlayStation game. Meshy's documentation has this great line. They say blurry plus stretched is almost always a UV problem, not a resolution problem. They handle UV unwrapping automatically and their pitch is essentially skip the UV unwrapping learning curve entirely. But if something goes wrong and your textures look bad, it's the UVs. It's almost always the UVs.
So the machine hides this step, but the failure pattern is still sitting there waiting.
And it's a genuinely hard computational geometry problem that remains resistant to full automation. You can't just mathematically optimize your way out of it because seam placement is partly an aesthetic judgment. Where is unobtrusive on this particular character? The algorithm doesn't know.
All right. We've got a clean mesh with good topology and sensible UVs. Now we make it look like something.
Texturing. And this is where the PBR stack comes in. PBR stands for Physically Based Rendering. It's a shading model that simulates how light actually interacts with surfaces. A full PBR texture set has 4 maps. Albedo is the base color, the raw surface color with no lighting information baked in. Normal is surface detail encoded as RGB vectors. Each pixel tells the renderer which direction that tiny patch of surface is facing, which creates the illusion of bumps, scratches, and fine detail without adding geometry. Roughness is how rough or smooth the surface is. A value of 0 is a perfect mirror. A value of 1 is completely matte. Metallic is whether the surface behaves like a metal, because metals reflect light differently than non-metals.
And Meshy generates all 4.
from a text prompt or a reference image. You type weathered leather with brass rivets PBR and it produces the full stack. It supports multiple art styles, realistic, 2.5D cartoon, Japanese anime, cartoon line art, oriental comic ink, up to 8K resolution. And it also handles normal matte baking, which is the process of taking all the surface detail from that high poly soup we started with and transferring it into the normal map of the low poly mesh. So your 5,000 polygon game asset looks like it has 600,000 polygons of detail, but all of that detail lives in the texture, not the geometry.
That's a neat trick.
It's the fundamental trick of modern real-time rendering. Games have been doing it for 20 years. Meshy just automates the whole pipeline.
Now we get to the stage Daniel was most fascinated by. The skeleton.
Auto-rigging. This is where the machine fits an armature, a hierarchical tree of bones and joints, inside the mesh. Meshy's AI automatically identifies whether the character is humanoid, quadruped, or a custom creature, and it generates a complete bone hierarchy, spine, limbs, fingers, tail, under 30 seconds.
It's not just placing bones, it's skinning them.
Skinning is the hard part. Skinning, also called weight painting, assigns every single vertex of the mesh to one or more bones with fractional weights that sum to 1.0. A vertex on the upper arm might be 100% influenced by the upper arm bone. A vertex right at the elbow might be 50% upper arm, 50% forearm. When the elbow bends, those blended weights create a smooth transition.
When the weights are wrong, you get the collapsing elbow.
The collapsing elbow is a perfect teaching moment. It's not a rendering bug. It's a bug in the linear blend skinning equation. Here's what happens. When a vertex is influenced equally by the upper arm and forearm bones, and the elbow bends past 90 degrees, the vertex moves to the mathematical midpoint of the two bone positions. But that midpoint is inside the arm, not on the surface. So the elbow collapses inward instead of maintaining volume.
The vertex is doing exactly what the math told it to do. It's just that the math is wrong for that situation.
The math assumes that averaging two bone positions gives you a point on the surface. It doesn't, once the angle gets extreme. There are two fixes. One is better weight distribution. More vertices near the joint assigned 100% to one bone, with a very narrow band of blended weights. The other is dual quaternion skinning, which handles large rotations without volume collapse by treating the transformation as a screw motion rather than a linear blend. Meshy claims its AI generates production quality weights that eliminate elbow collapse, knee pinching, and finger distortion, but the artifact is a vivid illustration of why skinning is difficult.
The rest pose, the T pose, is where all this gets calculated.
The rest pose, also called the bind pose, is the default pose of the character when no animation is applied. It's the pose the mesh was modeled in and the pose in which all the skinning weights were calculated. Usually a T pose. Arms out, legs straight, because that gives the algorithm the clearest separation between limbs. Once the character is rigged and skinned in the rest pose, you can drive it with animation data.
Which brings us to retargeting.
Animation retargeting is taking animation data created for one skeleton and mapping it onto a different skeleton with different proportions. So a walk cycle created for a standard human can drive a stylized cartoon character, or a quadruped, or, theoretically, a donkey. Meshy's skeleton naming matches Mixamo's conventions, which is a big deal. It means you can take a Meshy-rigged character, upload it to Mixamo, and get hundreds of animations that just work. Or use Meshy's own library of 600-plus preset motion clips, walk, run, idle, attack, jump, dance. Export as FBX or GLB with industry-standard bone hierarchies.
The full pipeline, from start to finish, one image in, maybe 2 to 4 photos if you want better results. Multi-view diffusion hallucinates the unseen angles. Neural reconstruction builds an implicit field. Merging cubes extracts a 600,000 face triangle soup. Remeshing produces clean quad topology with proper edge loops. UV unwrapping flattens the surface into texture space. AI texturing generates the full PBR stack and bakes normal maps. Auto-rigging fits a skeleton and computes skinning weights. And then you can drop it into a game engine and make it dance.
The whole thing, Meshy 6, highest quality, takes about 2 minutes for the model generation, under 30 seconds for the rig, full workflow under 5 minutes. Their newest smart topology model completes in about 10 seconds.
That's absurd.
It's absurd. 100 million models generated on the platform, 12 million users. And each one of those models is the result of this entire pipeline executing, stages that each represent decades of research compressed into seconds.
What does all this mean for someone actually trying to use these tools?
The practical value of understanding the pipeline is debugging. If your generated model has blurry textures, it's probably a UV problem, not a resolution problem. If your animated character's elbow collapses, it's a skinning weight problem. If the mesh deforms weirdly at the shoulder, your edge flow is fighting the deformation. Use Meshy's Remesh tool for clean topology. If the UVs are bad, re-unwrap in Blender with Smart UV Project and then retexture. For studio-grade Retopo, Blender's Retopo Flow add-on or Maya's Quad Draw.
The one-click illusion is powerful, but the failure pattern are all sitting there in the pipeline, waiting.
They each have a specific fix if you know which stage to look at. That's the difference between a user who can iterate and a user who just keeps hitting generate and hoping for a different result.
The philosophical takeaway is the one we started with. When a machine infers a skeleton, it's not finding bones that were always there. It's inventing a plausible skeleton based on statistical patterns learned from millions of training examples. That's the shift from measurement to imagination. Classical photogrammetry measures what exists. AI image to 3D imagines what probably exists.
As someone whose skeleton was inferred by a machine, I have thoughts.
I assumed you would.
The machine made decisions about me that I never made about myself. It decided my joint placement, my proportions, how my surface should deform when I move. None of that was measured. All of it was statistically derived from a distribution of other bodies, and it was probably close enough for animation purposes. But close enough for animation purposes is a strange standard to apply to a representation of a specific individual.
It's not a digital twin. It's a digital plausibility.
A digital plausibility. I like that. It's a model of what Herman Poppleberry probably looks like in three dimensions, given what he looks like from the front and the side. And the skeleton inside, it's what a skeleton probably looks like inside a body shaped like mine. The machine didn't discover me. It imagined me.
Yet it works well enough that people are shipping games with these models.
That's the thing. It works. The plausible version is good enough for most purposes. But the gap between plausible and accurate, that's where the craft knowledge lives. And that gap doesn't go away just because the pipeline got faster.
Let's leave you with one last thought about what happens when the machine invents bones. As these pipelines get faster and more automated, 10 seconds for a full model, under 5 minutes for the complete rigged character, what happens to the craft knowledge of 3D artists? Is understanding the pipeline still valuable, or does it become irrelevant when the AI handles everything?
I think it becomes more valuable, not less. Because when something breaks, and something always breaks, the person who knows which stage failed is the person who can fix it. The person who just hits generate is stuck.
At some point, generating a 3D model might become as trivial as taking a photo, but debugging a bad one will still require knowing what a UV is.
What a skeleton isn't.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. This has been My Weird Prompts. If you enjoyed this episode, leave a review on your podcast platform of choice. It helps other curious minds find the show. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.